Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Founders Club Radio.
Welcome to the Founders Club, where each week we talk to the founders and leaders of great private companies. I'm your host, John Coffin, and this week I'm joined in the studio by Billy Robinson, the CEO and founder of Port City Logistics, and Kevin Florence, the president and CEO of General Paper Goods Company. Good morning, guys.
Good morning, John.
Welcome. Thank you for being here. Billy, I'm going to start with you, if that's okay, and sure. Thanks so much for coming all the way up from Savannah last night. We really appreciate your taking the time to do that. Wondered if this morning you just describe Port City Logistics and your current scope of business, please.
Sure, no problem. Thanks for having me this morning. Before I get started, I just want to tell everybody what Port City Logistics is, what we do. We're considered a 3PL. 3PL in our industry stands for third-party logistics provider. So we're basically in the supply chain somewhat of the middleman. So you've got someone who produces or buys goods. Then we warehouse warehouse and distribute those goods for them to their end-user customers. So I just want to make sure everybody understands what a 3PL is if I refer to that.
So you are housing in your state-of-the-art warehouses, primarily in Savannah, goods, and then also actually making sure they arrive wherever they need to go.
That's correct. They come into us via different, mostly inbound containers, could be domestic, could be import, could be export. We supply them, we hold it for the customer, and then as they get orders for their from their customers, we deliver their goods.
Okay.
That's how that works. So, you know, basically, I tell everybody we're a warehousing and distribution company. Trucking is a big piece of what we do as well. An advantage for a customer, for a company doing business with somebody like us is we do this for a living. This is what we do. Someone who produces a good, that's their expertise. They need to, you know, may choose to do that and do that only. We take that burden of getting it, that distribution piece to their customer off of them. So, you know, also they don't incur the cost of the bricks and mortar and the equipment and that sort of thing.
So who would be some of your customers? Really, I would imagine it's a very broad group of customers.
It can be because of what's going on at the port down in Savannah, and I'll get to that in just a minute. But some of the customers we do business with are people like names that people would recognize, the International Paper, Georgia Pacific, BASF. We deal with a group called Satellite Logistics, which handles all of the Heineken beer products in the Northeast, the Southeast, Houston, and the West Coast as well.
So that's what I'm talking about. That's a great client, right there.
It's a great client, no doubt about it. It was a big win for us back several years ago. And so I tell folks, you know, that's where people can relate. You know, what do you do? What are you handling? Any Heineken product you see in the seven southeastern states came through Port City Logistics. Other names that people, we do work for Apple, CVS, and it's just a huge range of product mix, from anything from food and beverage, retail, wood products, chemicals. We do both hazardous and non-hazardous chemicals, electronics, building materials. So you really, and one of the cool things about our business is you just really never know what the next commodity is going to be in terms of where the next sales and service opportunity is going to be.
Now, I have to ask you, what's the strangest product you've ever gotten in the door?
Oh, gosh. Well, there's been a lot. You know, one thing that we do, and one thing we were known for a lot of years, and I think we still are, is we would tackle sort of the stuff that nobody wanted to mess with. And I can remember, especially early on, we've been in business since 2001, but early on, you know, we're just trying to make a living. So we would do just about anything. So these containers, for whatever reason, might turn over in a wreck or what have you. They'd have to have somebody to address the damaged goods. So I'll tell you, an odd one was 55-gallon drums of concentrated frozen orange juice.
Yeah,
that had been flipped over. And so we said, yeah, bring it to our warehouse. We unload it. I go out there. I still got pictures of it. And it's these, I mean, just like the little cans you see in the grocery store, but these are 55-gallon drums. Tops popped off of them. Smells like orange juice. It was quite unique. But those are the kind of things when you're trying to build a business that we tackle just to kind of enhance our reputation as somebody who, you know, will go the extra mile kind of thing. Yeah.
Take us back to 2001. Why did you start the company? And what were you thinking about when you started?
Well, that's a good
that
question.
Company?
I'll tell you that I was in industrial supply for 17 years. Mostly a salesman. I've been a salesman my whole life, so if I start selling you guys this morning, you'll know what's going on. But anyway, I moved through the ranks and had some great mentors during that period of time. And at the end, I was running a branch for a company out of Cleveland, and we had a courier business that was actually a vendor of ours doing some deliveries for us. It was called Port Express, and Port Express was owned by a guy named Larry Hearn, and Larry and I became friends. Larry knew some people that were building warehouses, and we're in this Georgia ports maritime community, and we could just see the way the wind was blowing. Imports and exports were really growing. The state was really behind what was happening at the Georgia Ports Authority. And so we grabbed a couple of other investors and went at it on a small scale. We started out with 5,000 square feet and 6 employees. Today we operate 6 locations in Savannah that add up to about 1.2 million square feet, and we have a little over 100 employees. So we saw the way that wind was blowing. We got together, and then we were silent. We had one operator, and the rest were silent investors at that point. In 2004, I came on. We bought everybody else out, and we've been doing it ever since. Since then, Larry's retired, and I've got some new partners, but that's how we got started.
So that's 1.2 million square feet. Help me with that. What's the visual on that? Is that acres or
I guess
football fields? Is there a way to describe that?
The easiest way to think about it is one way to think about it. I don't know if it's the easiest way, but if you go to the grocery store, you know, like a Publix or a Kroger or something like that, I don't know, Kevin, I would say those are probably 50,000 square feet.
That would be my guess, yeah, 50,000 feet.
Yeah, so if you go, if you think about that and then you think about 1.2 million in relation to the size of, say, a grocery store, then...
So we got a pretty
it's
huge
a lot of space.
Operation.
It's a lot of space, but I'll tell you that, you know, a lot of credit, and we're very blessed to have the economic engine that we have in our backyard called the Savannah Port and the Georgia Ports Authority. The state of Savannah, I mean, the state of Georgia is so involved and committed to what goes on there because it affects so many different people. I think the number, we just came off of our annual State of the Port address, where Curtis Fultz, the director, you know, gives just the state of what's going on and what happened in the year prior. The fiscal year ends in June 30th for them. And they were up in every category. And, you know, tonnage. And the other thing you start looking at is the growth of that port. It's the fastest growing port over the last 15 years. It's fourth in the nation in terms of total volume, tonnage, containers, that sort of thing. And, you know, it just – the thing that's very impressive is they try to stay ahead of the curve. They know the volume is going to increase. The capacity to handle more freight is in place. The record of decision just came through for the harbor deepening. So now the bigger ships can come through. So, you know, the future's bright. And my philosophy is, hey, if we can just get a little piece of that, we can just hang in there, we're going to see growth in Savannah. Could take us to other port cities, depending on who our customer base is. And look, we're positioned well, I think.
The Savannah port and the growth of that for the whole ecosystem has just absolutely been staggering when you think about jobs, GDP, state income revenue, et cetera. So really remarkable. Give us an update on the port deepening. I guess it's really only a couple of feet more that they need, but that's right. A really critical couple of feet.
Super critical. The depth is currently at 42 feet. They wanted to go to, I think it was 48 or 50, and they ended up at 47. Mm-hmm. So that'll allow them the ships, the larger what they call post-Panamax ships, to come up and down the channel without having to come in at high tide and come in light. And it's all economies of scale. It's all about cost. More containers on the bigger ships means less fuel. And so it's in Savannah being positioned that way and being able to offer everyone from the steamship and the cost savings just filter straight on down to the customer and everybody else. So, I mean, it puts us in a position where, I mean, the growth of Savannah should continue to increase.
I think Curtis said that there was something like 3 million TEUs, or the if you think about those
right.
containers coming through in the fiscal year of 2014. Yeah. That's just an incredible number. And these new, did you say call them Banamex?
Post-Panamax.
Those ships are going to be how large in comparison to the to what we currently think about the barges coming in and out of Savannah?
Right now, you're looking at ships that are coming in anywhere from, say, 3,500 containers to a big ship, maybe 4,500, 5,000 containers. These ships will be double that in some cases. I'm not an expert on it, but, with the widening and deepening of the Panama Canal, and that's slated to be finished in 2016, talking about our deepening, everything now has been finalized and they're started to award contracts, and feel very confident that construction will start moving dirt. They'll start moving dirt by the end of this year. So very positive for us. I think it's a three-year project is what it's supposed to be.
That's great. So then Savannah is really going to be positioned as the port for the future. And again, that's going to help you from a
position well, and with all the opportunity, and that's the other thing, that the GPA, the Georgia Ports Authority, their trade development group is as good as any, as professional, as good as any group I've ever been around. And so they create the product, they bring in the prospects, and they've got a nice product to sell.
So global trade is just to a neophyte like me, it's just incredibly complex. You have products coming in and out. You have the train and truck and ecosystem. How do you sort through all this, Billy? I mean, it's incredible that you guys are right at the the central point of all of this. And how does technology and innovation kind of come into play with your business?
Well, it's critical. You know, when we first started, and of course our business has grown rapidly, sometimes too rapidly, but we just committed, systems are everything. I mean, they're everything to most businesses today, and we just committed a pretty sizable investment to change out our WMS, our warehouse management system, to take us to the next level. We I guess it was back in 2006, we bought a WMS that did a good job for us up until where we are. But if we're going to continue to be competitive and have the opportunities and be able to present and capture new business, we got to get our systems in line. And so we've just pulled the trigger on that. We're in the initial stages. I've been through a couple of these with some other companies, and they can be brutal. But we've got a great team, and I know we'll pull it off. And hopefully this time next year, we will have our technology where it needs to be to take us to the next level.
So I'm a pretty simple-minded guy. So you mentioned Heineken, and so I'll just use that as an example. Tell me the life of a Heineken keg as it goes through the global supply chain.
Okay.
It starts, I guess, in Amsterdam, right, when it gets made.
Well, first
made.
You got to grow the hops, right?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe fast forward to when it comes off the line.
It comes
Heineken.
Off the line. Yeah. They throw it in a container, and it takes, I think it's 20-something days that it takes to get to Port of Savannah.
Probably comes out of Rotterdam.
Out of Rotterdam. Yeah. And what they have in place is any Heineken beer has to be consumed.
That's what I'm talking about. It has to be consumed.
Big on the consumption there, picking up on that.
Within 165 days. Okay. So if it's almost 30 days to get it, then you've only got 130 some days to get it into market and get it consumed again. So, and that's how it happens. It comes to us. It doesn't stay long, and the turnover is one of our best accounts. It comes in, it goes out very quickly because of that timeline and that expiration date.
So they're probably choosing to use, or you're choosing to use trucks rather than rail on that.
That's
I would
correct.
Think, because
that's
you correct. Have to go to a more of a specific location.
Well, it comes straight into our port. We use our equipment to go get the container. It comes to our facility. We unload it, scan it in, bin locate it, The order comes from them. They send, in this case, they send their truck in. They broker a truck to come in, pick it up. We pick the order, load it, and it goes to market.
Yeah. Fantastic. And then when it's done, do you guys ship it back as well, or
we do have those? We do have an account. It's called Kegspediter, and it's a return logistics operation. And what it is all these kegs that have been to market, they've been in restaurants, they've been in bars, and they're empty. This company has devised some software and some systems and some logistics to go pick those empties up. They bring them back to us. And these, again, are coming from seven southeastern states. And so we have load plans. We load them in 40-foot containers, take them back to the port. They load them on the ship, send them back over to Europe to be. And it's not just Heineken. This is everybody, Bass, you name it. If you can think of a European beer, we handle it, that keg.
This is global trade at its most beautiful point. It's a virtual cycle here. This is great.
Not bad at all. Yeah.
Billy, thanks. That's a great snapshot of your company. I appreciate that.
Sure.
Kevin, tell us about General Paper, and congratulations, I guess, on your 80th year.
Yeah, we celebrated our 80th anniversary in 2012. And in fact, had a big soiree at the Georgia Aquarium where we had all of our associates and their spouses. We had some customers and suppliers who participated with us there and had a great night together, kind of honoring the efforts that were started by my grandfather. And of course, his two sons came into the business in the 50s, but my grandfather, it's a story we're very proud of. It's a real slice of Americana, I think. He lost his job. It was Depression era. And he was actually a machinist working for the Atlanta newspapers when he was laid off, and was just like everybody else in that time, trying to figure out how to make ends meet and put a meal on the table. And he observed at the Georgia State Farmers Market, which at that time was in downtown Atlanta, that the farmers who brought their produce into the marketplace had a need for grocery sacks and craft wrapping paper and twine and so forth as they would bundle up their goods for their customers. And so he made a deal with what at that time was the only wholesale paper distribution company in the city, where he could fill the orders that he solicited from the vendors at the State Farmers Market. He would take the orders in the morning and go pick up the products in the afternoon and deliver it to the folks at the market and collect from them, and then he would in turn pay his supplier. And that is exactly how our business was founded and started and is real. Today, you know, we go through sort of the same processes. We're buying from manufacturers, and we're in that same supply chain that Billy referred to, where we are a mechanism for getting manufacturing products to the end users in a pretty broad array of market opportunities.
So you started out with paper and twine. Now you have over 2,000 inventory units and across a much broader scope of product lines. Can you describe that a little bit?
Sure. It's interesting that we would refer to those products as packaging products.
Okay.
And today we are still in the packaging products business. That has naturally expanded beyond the very limited offering that my grandfather had back in those days. But today we sell all of the protective packaging that would go inside a manufacturer's box to protect his widget. So all of the cushioning products or protective films. We sell the products that are used to close a box. So whether that's strapping or tape or glue. And we sell all of the products that are used to unitize boxes onto a pallet for shipment. So that would include stretch film and strapping products and edge protection and so forth and so on, as well as Billy, we may need to make a call on you. One of our newest products is for logistics providers. We import a inflatable airbag that gets used to protect products loaded into containers and tractor trailers, so that during transit the product doesn't shift around and cause damage. So
we call that a dunnage bag.
We call that a dunnage bag as well, and I'll be calling you tomorrow.
You got my call.
So certainly a pretty broad offering of packaging products that we traffic in. Another segment that we are strong in is what we refer to as facility supplies. So any manufacturer or logistics company or any place that people go to work, they have need to take care of the employees who come to work in those facilities. And we sell all of those products, from skincare products to hygiene products to cleaning products. So a wide array of products that get used in facilities, be they in commercial property, manufacturing, healthcare, school systems, government. So we have a wide open market in which we can market those products.
And so what really started as a hyper-local business 82 years ago is now regional, if not national, I guess.
Yes, we're fortunate that we've been able to participate in some national and even some global business because of the relationships that we've built, and we figured out how to solve the logistics challenges of getting product from the Southeast to these locations, either working with our suppliers or working with 3PL companies like Billy's. And that's a part of what we do today, is to try to build a set of solutions for our customers that helps them manage the supply chain in the most cost-effective way.
This is something that every starting company kind of faces at some point, is how do I grow my business from a local business to a regional, a regional to national, and now you've grown it to a global business. Sometimes you can do it on your own muscle, and sometimes you have to partner. And it's just interesting to me that you've found that partnership is the most effective way to go.
We identified some years back, I'm going to say 10 years ago or so, 15 years ago now, we saw a growing opportunity as many of the customers that we had and had history with were looking at ways to better manage their supply chain, and they were looking at better ways to manage their spend on these consumable items that we sell. And we saw a movement where centralized purchasing was taking place through these large corporations that had multiple locations through multiple geographies. And we saw that as a threat to our business, and we were attempting to figure out how to solve for that. And our solution ended up being, within our industry, there's several national marketing alliance groups who are represented by companies with similar type business models, who come together for the express purpose of helping each other solve for that multi-location customer who needs a uniform platform, perhaps needs technology by which they can order products from these multiple locations, which standardizes the pricing, standardizes the product offering. And so we kind of took a look at the landscape and found an organization that we believe best suited our needs and that capacity. And we've been a member of an organization called AFLINK, which is a Blackstone company since 2000. So we have 250 members across North America. We operate across a web order platform that solves for that one source of supply opportunity across the internet for many of these multi-location customers. And while this organization is made up of 250 type A entrepreneurial owners, private business owners, and sometimes it's like herding cats to get everybody on the same page. By and large, we've developed a platform in which we can deliver on that requirement by these prospects and customers of delivering uniformity of product across a standard platform with unitized pricing. So it's been pretty helpful for us.
That's remarkable, trying to get 250 people to price the same way.
To agree on anything, actually.
To agree on anything and to remain accountable to one another.
Yes.
So that's
yes.
really great.
Yep.
So the statistics are incredible. 70% of second-generation companies fail. 10% of companies make it to the third generation, and less than 1% make it to the fourth generation. I know you and your brother are in the third generation. You currently have the fourth generation coming on, but take me back to that point in your career where you decided, this is something I want to be in my dad's and my grandfather's business. You know, help us with how you made that decision in the first place.
I think it was a combination of fate and my wife, actually.
That's how a lot of great things happen. It has been my experience.
You get that answer every week, John.
Yeah, I'm gonna do a shout out to my wife here.
Me too.
All right, we're unified on that, ladies.
Yes, absolutely. I actually, it's interesting. I grew up in the business from probably 12 years old. I went to work in the summertime, at the company, unloading trucks and unloading boxcars and working in the warehouse. And when we got into the printing business, I actually learned how to run a printing press at 13 years old. So, it was kind of coursing through my veins from early on. But when I got grown and was in college and all full of knowledge, I was determined that I was not going to go into the family business. I was going to do something else. And met my wife in school. We determined to get married. And after several encounters with her will and a skillet, I was convinced that perhaps I should choose a different career path. And so I started actually a few months before I graduated from college and had one complete day of training by my dad before he gave me a prospect list and put me in the street to start trying to go sell to customers. So I learned under fire, as was the case with my brother. And to your comment about the generational challenges there, he started a year in the business after I did, and we've been told forever, that the first generation is the founding generation and the second generation builds the business and the third generation drives it off the cliff. And so our yoke for all these years, I've been at it 35 years now, my brother 34, our yoke has been just, and our mantra is just keep it between the ditches.
Uh-huh.
And so I think we're both cognizant of your point about the propensity for multi-generational businesses to fail, and committed to doing the things that are necessary for us to sustain the legacy and the heritage of the business that we have at hand.
Well, if you look over 82 years, there's always an element of there's surviving years and probably thriving years, and
no
it's
question.
Remarkable that you've been able to accomplish that. What are some of the cultural cornerstones of the business that perhaps were started by your grandfather or your father that exist today?
Yeah, it's interesting. We in 2009, which is when Jeff and I really were looking around and trying to determine how we wanted to take this great business opportunity that we found ourselves in control of. And we determined we didn't really want to do the same thing that our dad and grandfather had done, which was die in the business, having to make every major decision. And we wanted to build a, you know, a management team, a professional management team that would give the business the opportunity to survive beyond us and function without us on a daily basis. And so through some consultation, we determined that we really needed to build a long-term strategic plan. And part of that process was for us to identify what the core purpose of our business was and what our core values were as an organization. So we had some help with a facilitator who came in and tried to kind of coach us through that process. And we came up with a set of core values and a core purpose for our business. We spent literally hundreds of man hours with our leadership team dissecting this whole process. And we came away with, you know, the things that you would expect from a Southern-raised family business, and that is as core values, respect and integrity and agility was a big piece for us, because we felt like it was really important for us as a small business to be agile enough to adapt to the changing marketplace and to respond to customer needs. Persistence is another, because as you point out, John, that we certainly have highs and lows in our business, as most businesses encounter. And when you're in the bottom of the trough, the thing you got to do is just shoulder up and keep going. Mm-hmm. And so we identified these core values as sustainable values back to earliest days in the business. The real tough solution for us was, what's our core purpose? And, you know, in our business, it's almost a laughable situation as I talk with other people in the industry, and everybody touts their service levels and the quality of the product that they deliver. And we pretty much all have the same thing in our warehouse, so that's kind of a non-differentiator.
Right.
So after kicking it around for quite a bit, what we determined was what we're really good at is building and sustaining relationships. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the business environment has changed so dramatically with technology in recent years. But we see it every day and believe it, that at the end of the day, big business decisions are made between people. And certainly technology is a prerequisite. You can't get a swing at the plate today if you don't have the right systems in place and the processes in place to perform in business at the speed at which business is conducted today. But we still believe that it's a relationship that rules the day at the end. And so we came up with as our core purpose to win and nurture sustainable business relationships that support our core values.
Right.
So really proud of the way we kind of tied that all together, because I think it really is emblematic of how the business was founded, sustained through a second generation, and it's how we try to operate today.
That's really really interesting that there's those foundational principles that really started at the very beginning that you've built on. Congratulations. What an incredible story. So we have a lot of companies out there who are thinking about their supply chain, or maybe don't even know what supply chain is, but they probably have heard the words and know that they need to think about it. As companies review that process, what practical advice would both of you give to other business owners on how do you manage your supply chain more effectively, or, you know, what are some of the things that they can do? Billy?
Well, it's all about cost. But in addition to the cost, it's efficiency and expectation to their customer. So when you start looking at supply chain, especially through the years of the recession, a lot of companies that were struggling, one of the first things they did is looked at their supply chain to see where they could cut back and maybe save money. Maybe they had a supply chain that was in place for years. But when the recession, tough times came, they looked to say, hey, can we do something different? You know, cost and performance to the customer is the key. You know, many times when I talk to a potential new client, they're looking at bringing their goods in, import through Charleston, Savannah, Norfolk, maybe New York, New Jersey. I don't mind telling you, we work very closely with the Trade Development at Georgia Ports Authority. The first 15 slides of our presentation are selling that port and the reason they ought to come through that port. The last 15 slides are selling Port City Logistics and why they ought to use us or give us a chance to complete and be part of their supply chain. So, you know, cost is a big issue. I mean, there's a lot of providers out there. So they have to, I mean, my suggestion is look around and you know, talk to some folks and see what works best for you. But at the end of the day, the customer is the ultimate prize. We've got to take care of the customer. And for us, their customer becomes our customer as well. So anyway, that's what I would say.
Great. Kevin, thoughts on that one?
Really
outsourcing or, you know, there may be different elements of that for your business, but
our go-forward marketing strategy is all around supply chain and developing a set of solutions that we can take to the marketplace that deliver not just a quality product, but deliver consultative analytics around how the customer can perhaps achieve something in their business at a lower cost. It's not just the landed cost of the product, but it's the efficiency, to Billy's point. It's the workloading to make sure that as they are getting their products out of their plant and into their supply chain, into their channel to the end user, that they're doing so in the most cost-effective and efficient way. So our market bundle, and this is where we're really excited about the breadth of the offering that we have, because as our label and packaging business have expanded and our capabilities in those areas have expanded, it's created for us a nice story to tell about how we can help customers reduce their vendor base. So now the soft cost of procurement around managing multiple vendors, cutting multiple POs and receiving multiple shipments in and cutting multiple checks to those various vendors can be reduced dramatically, and we just happen to be the one supplier who can do those things for you. So broadening that bundle and providing consultative advice around how to gain efficiency in the operation and therefore reducing that supply chain cost is our whole go-forward strategy.
Okay, that's great. So cost, performance, analytics, quality, yep, all those are key factors to this decision for people as to how do I manage it or how do I perhaps outsource it and partner with somebody else like one of your two firms.
Absolutely.
Thank you. That's fantastic. Really want to kind of pull the plane up a little bit to 30,000 feet. Honored to be with you guys, two natives of Savannah and Atlanta, and really wanted to get your observations on the state of Savannah and Atlanta, respectively, as business owners and people who are generating jobs and revenue for our state. Just give us some perspective on that, Billy. How's Savannah doing these days?
Savannah's doing great. I mean, when I look at, for 17 years I was in industrial supply, we've got a great industrial base in Savannah. Gulfstream's in Savannah. Gulfstream is, I think somebody said the other day, well, I know every day at noon when I go to lunch, I can't hardly find a place because all the Gulfstream people, there's about 8,000 of them in Savannah now. So industrial base is good. Obviously, we've been talking about the port.
They need a cafeteria of their own.
And I think they got one, but they don't have enough. They need to build another one. You know, the port, obviously, is a great economic engine. And then the tourism in Savannah. Tourism in Savannah is huge. It continues to grow every year. The downtown area continues to grow. Ben Carter's in town. He's doing a lot with Broughton Street to make it much like the Charleston King Street and that sort of thing. The college in town, SCAD, is done a lot for the economy in Savannah. So Savannah's in a good spot. You know, in that corridor, going back to the port, the corridor of supply chain from the water side in Savannah up through Macon and into Atlanta, which is everybody knows the hub that Atlanta is with the Hartsfield Airport and that sort of thing. So, I mean, it's just almost one big connected line. I mean, it's good for the state. The state's right. in a great position. The state of the port, they talked about Georgia 2 years in a row being named best United States state to do business with. So by three different sources, can't name the sources, I don't know, they are. But, I mean, it just kind of lends itself and tells you kind of where we are, I think.
That's great. Yeah. Kevin, what about Atlanta?
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. I have friends and neighbors who come here from other places, and when they find out I've been here all these years, ask, you know, so what's different? And it's unbelievable to me the amount of growth that has taken place, you know, since I was a child and began to really observe that type of thing. But Atlanta's a great environment for business, and it's an international city now, and it's represented, you know, by either having multinational corporations where they have U.S. Operational offices located in Atlanta, or even national companies that have their headquarters in Atlanta, and Hartsfield Airport, to Billy's point. Having UPS headquartered here, having Coca-Cola here, there's just great it's a great business center that while it's not a huge manufacturing location as it was in earlier days, it is in fact a great logistics and service and distribution opportunity. But we find a lot of specialty opportunities out there, niche opportunities that fit within the market segments that we are seeking, and there's great resources here in the universities and so forth and so on. The it's a banking hub, so you know, there's great resource opportunities for businessmen and ladies in this area that continues to grow. It's an amazing, vibrant in spite of the traffic, it's really a great place to live.
Agreed. It's you know, we're really blessed as a state to have both Savannah and Atlanta.
Absolutely.
as critical cities in our infrastructure. I'm going to shift gears. I ask everyone what the best business advice you've ever received is. Billy, I'll start with you.
Surround yourself with good people. Give them a good outline of what you expect from them, and let them do their job. And don't, however it gets done, as long as it's efficient, let them go with it. We've done that in Savannah at Port City. We got a great team, and we're very collaborative in what we do, and it works well.
Excellent, Kevin.
Well, I have to go back to something. I was very fortunate to work with my grandfather as I came into the business, and he was still alive and came to work every day. And he was quite a character, and he was a simple man. He said to me early on, if you want to be successful at this, son, you give your heart to the Lord and your hide to the paper business. And I think that was as succinct and as important as any other advice I've ever gotten, and I try to keep centered up with that.
Incredible. Those are both great. Surround yourself with great people, and commit, I guess, is how I would summarize that great mini sermon there. All right, we're kind of coming to a close, but I'm going to go into what I call the speed round. This is where I ask you some random questions. So, you guys ready for that?
I'm nervous.
Nervous. Okay, you should be. So, Billy, what did you want to be when you were growing up?
A fireman. No, I'm
fireman.
Yeah, a fireman. Yeah. I mean, you know, every little boy wants to grow up be a fireman, right? Now, when I want to grow up, I want to be like my dad. That's what I wanted to do, be like my dad. He was a cool cat.
Was he a fireman?
He wasn't a fireman.
Yeah.
But he got up and went to work every day and taught me how to do it, and he's a great guy.
Yeah, fantastic. favorite vacation spot, Kevin?
Oh, boy, we've gone to the Georgia coast for years and years and years, vacationed on the Golden Isles at St. Simon's and Sea Island. Our kids grew up there, and we probably created a real burden for ourselves because every summer there was an expectation around that's what we're going to do. But I've been fortunate enough to travel a lot of great places, but that still holds a really special place for me and my wife.
Okay. Yeah, it's a special place, that whole Golden Isle area, Billy knows well, just a little south of Savannah. Billy, if you could be a pro or a college athlete, what position would you play and what team would you be on?
Long-time, lifetime Falcon enthusiast. Look, the position, I like Matt Ryan, so I wouldn't take his spot, but they need help on defense, so middle linebacker. How about that?
All right. That's fantastic. Yeah, we need more middle linebackers.
Yeah, no question.
We need to get Sean Witherspoon back. We're missing him this year, right?
Yeah,
that's great. Kevin, favorite golf course that you've ever played?
Old Head.
Now, where's Old Head? I haven't heard of that one.
It's a little south of Cork in Ireland, and I had a chance to play there about, I guess, 3-4 years ago, and actually, this was a surreal experience. The fellow that I played with that day, we flew in there on a helicopter. So Old Head sits on a little finger of land out into the Irish Sea, and it has a lighthouse out on the point, and the water is crashing on the land there, 300 feet below the golf course. And the day that we played, it was a Chamber of Commerce day. The sky was blue and the winds were calm, and there was virtually nobody on the course, and so we had Irish caddies who were betting against us. And it was just a phenomenal experience.
That's great.
Hope to get back there one day.
Sounds good. Billy, favorite movie?
I got a couple. Rudy, good Irish Catholic boy. Rudy the underdog, man, he made it. And then Jerry Maguire, the ultimate salesman, gets the air knocked out of him and gets it back up on his feet and show me the money, man. Huh?
Help me help you, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
That's fantastic. Kevin,
favorite
movie?
Oh, my. I don't know. It's funny. My wife and I we put in one of these entertainment units in the basement, and we have a couple that we play golf with a lot, and they're big movie buffs, and they're always quizzing us when we see them, what'd you watch recently? And I never can remember the name or who was in any of them. And it's become a laughing situation almost, how my inability to retain that type of information. So I don't know that I have a favorite movie. We watch a lot of movies, but can't say that I have a favorite.
All right, great. I want to thank you both for joining us today. This has been great. Billy, tell our listeners how to get in contact with you or learn more about Port City Logistics.
Probably the easiest way is via the internet, our website, portcitylogistics.com.
Great. Kevin?
Yep. Same thing, generalpapergoods.com or genflexlabel.com.
Fantastic. Again, thank you both. And join us again next week for another Founders Club broadcast, sponsored by Atlantic Capital Bank and powered by Business Radio X.